This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak with Jesse Reynolds, who's the program director at the Center for Genetics and Society. Welcome to California Politics Today.
Thank you.
Essentially, we're going to be talking about Proposition 71, but before we do that, tell us just a little bit, or as much as you want, about the Center for Genetics and Society, where it comes from, where it gets its funding, and what its mission is.
Yes, the Center for Genetics and Society is a public education and advocacy organization. We work to inform civil society about the growing challenges of new human genetic and reproductive technologies.
What issues have you been involved in before Prop 71 to give people an idea about sort of what your orientation is to these things?
Well, our initial concern is that some new technologies coming around the convergence of reproductive and genetic technologies present some grave challenges. In the big picture, they're starting to open up the door to the prospects of human genetic engineering.
Right.
And that raised some alarm bells with us. Society was not having an adequate and informed discussion about these technologies. Now, we are a progressive organization, and we are a pro-choice organization, but we looked at these technologies and said, wait, this has the potential to lead to a human future where there's we don't want to go down the road to the human future of genetically enhanced people versus genetically natural people and that sort of thing. And I think most Americans don't want that either.
And essentially, that's what you see as the threat. That's what you see as a possible threat from these emerging technologies.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are some of the technologies being developed today could open the door towards those much more extreme technologies, and those extreme technologies do have their advocates.
Right.
Now, I mean, I'm not saying that Prop 71 is necessarily a direct part of that.
Right.
I'm just saying that's where the center had its start. And as we got into this, we started to look at, for example, human genetic engineering. We said that should probably be off the table. Human reproductive cloning, likewise, is almost universally opposed in America. Polls have like 90-95% opposition to human reproductive cloning.
How does your opposition to the sort of the biological aspect of this intersect with your concern about who controls and who profits from this technology?
Well, I think that's one of the key questions. In America, we lack adequate regulation. Right now, at the federal level, for example, the part of the government that comes closest to adequately regulating these technologies is the Food and Drug Administration. But their mandate does not thoroughly cover reproductive technologies.
Is part of this in computer technology? There's been the problem that the technology advances faster than the law. Is that also a problem with biotechnology?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. And what we're saying is that we need to take a moment to start talking about the big picture, where we want to draw the line. Okay, human reproductive cloning is almost universally opposed, and we don't want to go there. Yet at the same time, the new biotechnologies and the new reproductive technologies do have great potential to benefit people, to improve health, and to create cures and so forth. Somewhere in there, society needs to draw a line, and taking it just one small step at a time is not going to lead to effective policy.
In fact, what we have here, it seems, is a dual-use technology, something that nuclear power that could be used to heat homes and blow up cities, that genetic technology is something that could cure diseases or create a race of transhumans.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a pretty safe analogy. So it would be like but we need the institutions, we need the understanding, and we need the laws to safely control this.
Okay, so within that context, how does Proposition 71 and your critique of it fit in?
Well, our original we became concerned about the aspect of stem cell research as it relates to cloning.
Right.
Just to back up a little bit here, there's a number of sources of stem cells.
Right.
There's adult stem cells,
right,
which pretty much have no controversy around them.
Right.
There are embryonic stem cells that come from the embryos that are left over after in vitro fertilization,
right,
processes. Now, as a pro-choice organization, we don't have a particularly strong criticism of that.
And that connection comes into the fact that any pro-choice organization certainly acknowledges the constitutional right of a woman to decide what happens to her embryo/fetus up to 3 months, and if it's destroyed 6 days after it's generated or after it's unfrozen, that's certainly within the purview of that right. Is that
right,
what you're thinking?
Certainly in the case of IVF clinics,
right,
these are embryos that are going to be destroyed anyway.
Okay.
Right. So, but then a number of stem cell researchers say, well, what we want to do is we want to create embryos using cloning technologies,
right,
to extract stem cells from them, which destroys the embryo,
right,
so that we can then have embryonic stem cells that genetically match the person who donated the tissue that was cloned.
Exactly. Now, this is what Professor Melton at Harvard wants to do.
Yes.
And has asked Harvard for permission to do that. He's going to take cells, presumably skin cells, from people with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes, denucleate eggs, put their genetic material in, and create embryos that are genetically identical, except for the mitochondrial DNA with the source, and then use those to generate stem cells that would be acceptable to the immune system of the people from whom the skin cells were taken. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Now, that's variously called, the process is called somatic cell nuclear transfer.
Right.
Some people call it, we tend to use the phrase research cloning.
Right.
And other people use the term therapeutic cloning.
Right.
It's talking about the same thing, though.
Right. It's that process that I just described.
Right.
Now, do you have a view on that? Is that good, bad, indifferent? How do you feel about that?
We think the research cloning has promise, has the potential to develop therapies, but it needs to have responsible oversight of it. A good example is the United Kingdom.
Right.
They are one of the strongest advocates of research cloning, their government, yet they have a regulatory body.
What is that body called, do you know?
The HFEA, the Human Fertilization and Embryo Authority.
Okay. It sounds a lot like the Central London Hatchery in Brave New World, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. Basically, though, that's what it's trying to prevent.
Okay.
Is to prevent these technologies from running amok. And the HFEA says, okay, these technologies are allowed, but these other technologies are banned, and these here in the middle we're going to regulate.
And where exactly does this body get its authority and its membership? From the government? From the medical societies?
Was,
or where exactly?
It is mandated by law.
Okay.
Okay. So what it says, for example, with research cloning is, okay, apply for a license. Show to us that you can do this in an effective, in a responsible, in an ethical way.
How does that differ from what I assume is called the Human Subjects Committee at Harvard University?
Okay, Harvard University, as an individual institution,
right,
might have effective oversight. I'm not particularly familiar with that.
Right.
But just about a 45-minute drive away from Harvard is the headquarters of ACT, the Advanced Cell Technology.
Yes, I did an interview with Robert Lanza about 2 or 3 weeks ago about
right,
their retinal stem cells.
Right. Now the types of what their subjects basically solely to voluntary regulation.
Right. And voluntary regulation sounds like an oxymoron.
Right. Exactly. I mean, we've seen where that's led in for example, voluntary environmental regulation.
Right.
It sounds good, but it doesn't really go anywhere. And so, you know, ACT has an ethics advisory board and so forth, but what we're concerned about is there is not effective, consistent, national oversight of technologies like research cloning that have both promise but also potential pitfalls.
Okay, so you have concerns both about the content of the research and the process by which it's authorized.
Well, I think that the lack of a responsible mechanism to authorize the research opens the door for the content of the research to go down the road.
Right, exactly. Now, the Proposition 71 would set up a an Institute for Regenerative Medicine,
mm-hmm.
which presumably would regulate the at least the dispersal of the funds here. Do you see that as an adequate protection against the dangers that you're worried about?
Well, you know, I've been reading the language of the law, and I don't think there's adequate oversight of the research, particularly the research cloning aspect that would be funded by that.
Okay, give us your overall assessment of Prop 71.
Well, that was the initial contact and interest that we as an organization had with that. But what we've done is we've started to we're now part of a broader progressive pro-choice liberal coalition.
Does that coalition have a name?
It's primarily under the organization, the Pro-Choice Alliance Against Proposition 71.
Okay.
They have a website at, I believe it is, allianceagainst71.org.
Okay.
We are an endorser, organizational endorser of their statement.
Do you know who else is in that alliance?
Yeah, for example, the organization Our Bodies, Ourselves.
Okay. Sort of our genes ourselves by now, wouldn't
it? Right, no, Our Bodies, Ourselves is the Boston, it's a Boston-based prominent women's health and pro-choice advocacy.
Okay, who else? And then I want to get back to the women's aspect of this.
There are a number of well-known individual women's rights advocates. You have Francine Coiteau, who is based in California and was the founder of the Pacific Institute for Women's Health.
Right.
Diane Beeson is a medical sociologist at Cal State Hayward. Tina Stevens, a professor of bioethics and the history of bioethics at Berkeley.
Okay, so why don't you address that a little bit right now? What are the particular issues having to do with women's health or women's exploitation under Prop 71?
Oh, and if I could just add one
final thing.
A prominent endorser of Prop 71 fairly recently, the California Nurses Association.
Right, I interviewed their president yesterday.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Here on the site.
Yeah.
Right.
So, for example, so as we came together, as these and a number of environmentalists and women's advocates and so forth came together, we developed quite a long list of concerns about these. For example, something that Judy Norsegian of Our Bodies Ourselves brings up is that these processes are going to require enormous amount of women's eggs for the experimentation.
Say again more exactly why it'll require so many women's eggs?
Well, every experiment with research, doing research cloning, requires an egg.
And no one has fantasized about creating artificial eggs. There's only one place to get those, and that's women's ovaries, right?
Well, I mean, the scientists are saying, the advocates of Prop 71 are promising this in a way, or should I say they're suggesting this is just around the corner, that we will be able to develop artificial eggs from stem cells.
Oh.
So sort of once you get the ball rolling,
It's
going to be self-sustaining. Well, maybe or maybe not. Right now, eggs are required.
Okay.
A large number of eggs will be required.
Okay, and how will they be acquired?
Well, euphemistically called egg donation.
Right.
Okay, but this is an invasive surgical procedure.
Right.
People typically undergo that type of procedure voluntarily in large numbers to benefit science. So women are reimbursed for their expenses.
Right.
And what these expenses are is a little bit flexible.
So this means that lower socioeconomic groups may tend to gravitate towards this procedure while the people who are going to be benefiting from the research will shy away from it.
Yes. And to focus on who, so we've said, well, wow, the poor women who tend to be women of color are going to be the ones who are going to need you know, the $6,000 or $7,000 or $10,000 or whatever they will be reimbursed for their pain and suffering,
right,
will undergo the procedure. Yet the type of medicine that's developed from this is more likely to be a very expensive and, as I said, customized medicine.
Right.
So they talk about a personal what is personal stem cell repair kit is a phrase I think that the advocates have used.
Right.
Well, personal stem cell repair kit doesn't sound very cheap to me.
Right. Now, speaking of cheap, one of the arguments in the on the pro 71 side is that going ahead with this research will drastically lower the health care costs in California and save taxpayers vast amounts of money. Does that seem plausible to you?
No, it doesn't, for a couple reasons. One is, I read over the economic analysis where they derived those numbers.
Right.
And essentially the advocates arbitrarily picked a number of diseases, I think they said.
This was the research that was done in Menlo Park by a company hired by Prop 71.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And they arbitrarily picked a number of diseases, and they arbitrarily picked a percentage reduction in the cost of those diseases to society that this would create, and from that they calculated billions in savings.
Right.
But as far as I could tell, they were pulling the numbers out of thin air.
And more to the point, I've never heard of a new breakthrough medical technology that costs less than its predecessor. Have you?
Well, exactly. That's our concern. We're not saying that this isn't going to develop cures. It may and it may not. But what it does develop will be expensive. And if it's covered by health insurance, that means our premiums will go up. And if it's not covered by health insurance, it means that only the very wealthy will be able to afford these technologies.
Okay. Then that's a good way to transit over, I think, to a non-biological but a financial aspect of Prop 71 that I assume as a progressive organization you have some opinion on also, namely that the Proposition 71 calls for the socialization of the risk and the privatization of the profit.
Yes.
Why don't you address that a little bit?
Well, so it's a $3 billion bond measure. This is billion with a B, just to be clear. So that's $3,000 million that the advocates of this want us to lock up into one particular line of research for 10 years. It may or may not develop therapies and cures in that time. With interest, this would amount to $6 billion. This money will go to, yes, it'll go to, the universities of California, the various campuses. It will go to nonprofits. It will also go to private biotech companies. The money does not necessarily even have to be spent in California. And then if patentable discoveries are invented, then the recipients of the grants, which, as I said, will include private biotechnology companies, will likely retain a significant share of the intellectual property rights.
Well, the bill says that there'll be royalties paid to the state.
Yes.
How convincing is that?
Well, the language says basically we'll work out the details later.
Right.
Okay, but if you look at the precise language, it actually favors the recipients of the grants over the state. The state is to have an opportunity to be reimbursed for the subsidy, whereas the researchers, I'm trying to think about exactly how it says, they must retain the incentive to conduct further research.
Right.
So the language slightly favors the private biotechnology companies and the other recipients of the grant in the patent language.
Are you sure about what you just said about the money doesn't need to be spent in California?
My reading of the law, let me just be clear, I'm not a lawyer.
Right.
I studied science and policy, but not law.
Right.
I went through there, and what I found was that new facilities that are constructed do
right.
have to be in California.
Right.
Okay. But research grants, it did not say anything about where they are actually spent at.
Well, when I interviewed Robert Lanza, who's the chief scientist at ACT, Advanced Cell Technology, he said they were opening a new headquarters in California just to take advantage of the law.
Yes.
I got the impression from him that the money could only be spent in California, therefore they were relocating, at least
right.
building a new office.
Now, I've heard, but I couldn't find it in the law, and I read it just a couple of days ago. I've heard that the grant recipients must have an office in California.
But they could spend it in Massachusetts or India or wherever.
That was my reading, yes.
Okay, now, also about the distribution of money, this money, when you say locked in, how locked in is it? How locked in does a constitutional amendment lock in some kind of funding like this?
Well, yeah, this is our concern. This is part of our concern. It locks it into this one particular type of research that may or may not create benefits. It's a 10-year program. It would distribute $300 million approximately per year. Now, what if we say, oh, wow, stem cell research isn't quite as promising as we thought it was a few years ago. What can we do about it? Well, for the first 3 years, we can't do anything. It can't be changed.
Right.
After that, it requires a 70% supermajority of both houses of the state legislature plus the governor's signature to modify.
Which is pretty hard to get.
Yeah, and that, if you know California politics, it's pretty hard to get what, if the 55 or 60% right. that's required to raise any revenue.
So essentially, if the research enterprise were a ship and there were various islands out there, this essentially sets the course for a particular island called embryonic stem cell research,
right.
and locks in the navigation device to go there. And if new islands pop up that we've never thought of, that we haven't thought of yet, or that exist now and people haven't realized their potential, and those become very viable means for dealing with some of these issues,
mm-hmm.
there's no way that that money can be rechanneled in those directions. The ship, the course of the ship is set, unless 70%, as you said, of the crew and so on, votes the other way.
I think something to remember is gene therapy.
Right.
It was sort of a hype about 6 or 7 years ago.
Right.
And what if we had locked in $3 billion into gene therapy 10 years ago? Where would we be now? Gene therapy has cured a couple of people, but also the experiments have killed a couple of people. It didn't work out quite as well, and we don't hear much about it anymore.
No, we don't. The head of the California Nurses Association yesterday in our interview stressed the idea that this $3 billion will be essentially taken out of the general the $6 billion necessary to pay off the $3 billion original bonds will be not available for any other kind of medical needs or educational needs or any kind of needs of the people of California. And we were trying to work out some kind of calculus to figure out whether the sum total of human betterment would be better served by putting this into the research or using it to take care of people who actually exist already. What's your thought about that?
Well, we all want to improve the health of our neighbors, of Californians and Americans. And if you consider that about 15% of Californians don't have health insurance, most likely these people are seeing their primary care physician much less often than they should be. There's basic public health measures that are not being adequately addressed, air quality and so forth. That if we want to improve the health of Californians, there's much more cost-effective ways to do it than to be throwing $3 or $6 billion, which is what it comes out to be in the end, at one particular line of speculative research.
Okay, say a little bit about the controls that now exist for medical research that would be obviated by Prop 71.
Well, it doesn't change the law about what is and is not allowed.
Right.
It throws a lot of money at what the federal government is not funding.
Right.
But there's nothing that the federal government has banned.
Right, no, I meant in terms of informed consent and open meetings and issues like that.
Right, right. The law in a number of places has exemptions from Open Meetings Act and the Public Records Act.
And what's the ostensible purpose for that, and what do you see as the real purpose for that?
Well, some of the exemptions, I think, are fairly reasonable, assuming they're not abused.
Such as, which are the reasonable ones?
Patients' medical records are being discussed.
Right.
Okay. Well, we don't need that sort of stuff in the public record. I'm going to be the first to agree with that.
Right.
But for example, there's a couple of examples. One that comes to mind is that there's the primary governing body is the ICOC, the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee, which governs the proposed Institute for Regenerative Medicine.
Right.
Now, leaving aside the fact that the name is a little misleading because there's no independent citizens on the committee,
right.
It is advised by a couple of working groups, three of them. One of the working groups is the Medical and Scientific Funding Working Group. It advises the ICOC on which grants to fund. And there's two other working groups, one for facilities and one for I believe, the ethical oversight of these. Now, these working groups, it says, the members of the working groups are not employees of the state.
Right.
So they're exempt from the public records requirements in the Open Meetings Act. Now, our concern is that, well, if these working groups are really where the decisions are being made and the ICOC turns into a rubber stamp authority,
right,
then the decisions are being made behind closed doors.
By whom exactly, and what's their relation to the research and the money from it?
Well, the funding working group is entirely composed of scientists, researchers, representatives, I believe, of the biotech companies who might receive grants,
right,
and from members of the disease patient advocacy groups,
right,
who historically do have close ties to the biotech and pharmaceutical industries.
Does this mean that there would be people in position to essentially grant themselves money?
Well, now, there is language that says, an individual must recuse himself if there's a decision being made about a grant that would go directly to his or her entity.
But if you have person A and person B running entities X and Y, respectively, there's nothing to stop person B from approving Project X and vice versa.
Right. Log rolling, as it's called,
right,
sometimes. Trading votes. And when these meetings are behind closed doors, I think it just does not have enough oversight of an enormous amount of money.
Okay. Now, if let's say a person thinks embryonic stem cell research is ethically sound and they want to go ahead with it, they want to see it have ethical guidelines, but they don't like the funding and the other provisions of Prop 71, is there anything on the horizon that would give them hope and any place else they could look for support of their particular position should they want to vote against 71, or should it be defeated?
I think getting Kerry into office as president would be a big step.
Why is that?
He has repeatedly said that he would lift the restrictions on embryonic stem cell research funding that President Bush has imposed. There's even a secondhand comment, I believe I read it in the New York Times, where he said that might be his first act as president.
Okay.
Might be to lift the restrictions on funding.
And do you know how much funding he's been talking about?
Well, the total amount of funding right now, coming out of the federal government, out of the NIH, there's a total of about $125 to $150 million total to stem cell research. But because of the restrictions that Bush has imposed, only about $20 million of that goes to embryonic stem cell research.
Okay, that's on a yearly basis.
Right, and the rest, yeah, exactly, annually. The rest of that goes to adult stem cell research.
Okay, so there's about $20-25 million now, and do you know what Kerry has suggested he might fund level?
I have not heard any specific numbers, but if he just frees up all of the existing money,
right,
it would allow money to be shifted from adult stem cell research,
right,
embryonic stem cell research, and there we're talking about $125 million.
Okay, well, we talked about Kerry, we're talking about politics. Say anything you want about the politics of Prop 71, who's supporting it, who's opposing it, how you see the likely vote, and what your organization and the ones you're affiliated with are doing to push things in your direction.
Well, what we're doing is we're trying to get the message out there that this is not a referendum about stem cell research. This is not a referendum about Bush, and it's not a referendum about abortion. And unfortunately, that's what many have made it out to be, that if you are pro-stem cell research and you are anti-Bush, then you must vote for 71.
And the supporters of 71 haven't done anything to disabuse people of that notion, certainly.
Yeah, exactly. They are riding the wave of anti-Bush sentiment in California.
And they're essentially trying to reduce the argument to, if you hate Bush, vote yes on 71 to stick it to President Bush, right?
Right, and what we have to remember is this is a vote on a specific initiative. It's about $6 billion going to fund one line of research with inadequate oversight. It's a line of research that we support.
Right.
But we support it with responsible public funding, responsible public oversight.
Okay. Why don't you just sort of wrap up and explain why the Center for Genetics and Society is opposed to 71 and what you see as the future of embryonic stem cell research in the presence of its defeat?
Well, What I personally hope to see is a defeat of Proposition 71 and a victory of John Kerry as president. Hopefully he will not only open up public funding for embryonic stem cell research, but he said we need to move forward with ethical stem cell research, with responsible oversight. And I hope he follows through with that. The Center for Genetics and Society, we have a website at www.genetics-and-society.org, along with the Pro-Choice Alliance Against Proposition 71, are going to be working to get the message out that this is actually it's not a two-sided debate on abortion, which is what some of the initial framing was, but there's at least three sides to it, and we are a progressive pro-choice coalition who advocate no on 71.
In fact, the one of the arguments of the pro 71 people is that it will make California, or return California to its position as the leader in stem cell research, medical research, scientific breakthroughs, and so on. Do you see it as necessary to vote yes on 71 in order to have that happen, or under the alternative scenario that you've sketched out, essentially a Kerry presidency and renewed funding under better ethical and financial arrangements, that California could, assuming that's an important thing for jobs and prestige and people feeling good about themselves, could California still emerge as a leader in stem cell, embryonic stem cell research, even if Prop 71 is defeated?
Yeah, I mean, California has the largest number and the largest concentration of biotechnology companies, not only in the U.S., but in the world. And I think that California can, should, and will remain the leader in biotechnology research. Hopefully, though, it will do so under responsible oversight.
And, of course, it also has groups like yours that are trying to ensure that there is adequate ethical oversight.
Absolutely.
So thanks very much for talking to us, and maybe we'll get back to you again, maybe even set up some debates with you and some other people, if I can find anyone on the yes side who's willing to appear on the show here.
That'd be great.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Bye.
Bye-bye.